Hello, welcome to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And this is Dr. Lana Love.
Welcome to our show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on our show. Senator Michael D. Brown, Senator of the District of Columbia, D.C. Thank you for connecting with us and accepting my invitation to come on Universal Soul Love. So exciting to have you with Lana and I for the interview.
Well, I've got to tell you that over the years, it's been my good fortune to run into many Australians, and I've never met one I didn't like. So I'm happy to be here.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah, no, everyone in Australia will be really happy to hear that, for sure.
I've had some fun.
They generally do like Americans here, I'm happy to say, and people do get along pretty well here generally. It's a lot like America, or America's a lot like Australia, depending on which way you want to look at it.
I guess I haven't met many Americans. David is, I guess, the first American that I've known very closely, and it's always quite fascinating to look at the similarities and the differences between the culture.
Yeah, law enforcement. Because I have a law enforcement background. Excuse me, more private security. But law enforcement's very different here, and things are a little bit more diplomatic, and things are done not so much the way I did them in the court system, in an adversarial way, and it's a little less confrontational here. But so there's a little bit of a difference in the cultural attitudes, but very much the same. People are people everywhere with the same similar issues, and not a lot of Americans in this area that I've met. But anyhow, we're here to have a great show, and like I said, thank you so much for coming on,
My
Michael.
pleasure.
And Michael, I believe that you actually have your own show that's called Shadow Government. Is that
Yep,
right?
sorry,
Shadow
Shadow
Politics.
Shadow
And
Politics.
the name comes from the fact that I'm referred to, even though my title is United States Senator, I'm often referred to as a shadow senator because I don't have a vote in the
Okay.
Senate. So that's where the title comes from. And the idea of our show is just to start a dialogue about some of the things that we feel are important and to get the word out about our disenfranchised status in the District of Columbia, because most Americans do not understand that the people of the District of Columbia don't have a vote in their own national legislature. So that's kind of the purpose of the show. And if you follow American politics, you know that there's great discord in the United States right now. There's especially on Capitol Hill. We can't seem to get things accomplished because we can't seem to talk to each other.
No, we
So
call
part of the
it
show
gridlock.
is aimed at that. I'm sorry?
Yeah, gridlock.
Gridlock,
That's been
yes.
going on for a long time.
I guess I didn't follow American politics in the past, but certainly because of my relationship with David, I've been doing that more and more. And I guess something that really strikes me about the difference between America and Australia is the disparity between the different states. It's almost like that they seem to be almost sometimes like different countries with different values, where in Australia there's much more of a continuity of culture and perhaps even more of a sense of the same cultural national values.
Yeah,
Well,
it's
although Len, I think that's true and has always been true, I think it's more pronounced now than it has been at some times in the past. I mean, in certain ways, it's certainly not. But yes, there is a distinctive culture, and it's more regional, I believe, than it is state by state. So, you've got to have a kind of a West Coast culture and a Northeastern urban culture and a Southern culture, and yes, they're very and a Western culture too, and they're all very different in many ways. Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right because I grew up in the Boston area for 40 years and then went to Florida to write my books. And I found that Sydney, Australia is more like New England in many ways with the laws and the cultural attitude than, say, Orlando is to Boston. The people and the way business and people do their work. So you're absolutely right. And people don't understand that in foreign nations, they think Americans are a certain way and that America is a certain way. And I say, I don't think that's true. Many parts, if you go to the South or to the West or wherever, very different, and it's very regional, and people have vastly different beliefs and attitudes. And Australia is the size of the population of Australia is about the size of, I'd say, New York City. So it's just different.
Well, you know, when I was 18 years old, I was a hippie, I decided to go across country and find myself. That's what we were doing in the 60s and 70s, finding ourselves. And I went to every state in the continental United States. But I can tell you, as a kid from New Jersey, people in Australia probably have more in common with the people of California than I did when I went out there. I mean, it was like culture shock, to walk out on a beach with people with long blonde hair and surfboards. And, you know, I was used to Coney Island. That was, you know, that's how I looked at the shore. In fact, I think only people in New Jersey, everybody else in the world calls it the beach in the United States, but we always called it the shore. But yeah, there were a lot of differences, and it was a great experience for me. But
Michael, this was before you became a hippie, or after?
No, I was a hippie at the time.
Okay. I was going to say a hippie.
We all grew our hair long, and dressed exactly the same, and listened to exactly the same music, so we could express our individuality.
That's I had long hair when I was 18, and
I was part of that, you know,
in the 80s.
And I had a sister. My older sister used to say, "I don't have anything against long hair. It just looks dumb on you." And now that I look back at pictures of me during that period of time, I'm like, yeah, why didn't I get it? It does look dumb on me. So, but yeah, we all did that, and it was really, you know, we were really a generation at that point in time that was really trying to find its way. We had come out of a different, we had come out of a completely different background, and we're moving into uncharted territory. And it was a great time to be a young person, to be honest with you, in the United States.
That was an exciting time, and these are exciting times. I think more than ever.
Yes.
In my lifetime, I've never seen some of the things that have been happening in the past couple of years, or even in Australia. I've never seen these things before, and I'm surprised to see them in the world. I don't even know where to go with this. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your experiences. You were talking to me a little bit about Jimmy Carter just before the show, which,
you know, so I got involved with
Jimmy Carter.
You're not going to tell us that Jimmy Carter was a hippie as well, are you?
He was
wasn't a hippie. He longed to be a hippie. I don't know if you remember. He said that he lusted in his heart at one time.
Really?
But no, he was a teetotaling. He was actually very, very, I don't know what you'd call it, regular guy, but you know, he was extraordinary too. He was a graduate of the Naval Academy, for example, and he was assigned to a submarine. I don't know if he was the commanding officer of a submarine or second in command. I can't remember, but he was on a nuclear submarine. And so he was very kind of traditional, went into the Navy, then went and took over his father's business and made a gazillion dollars, then became, of course, governor of Georgia and president of the United States. But I got involved in politics right out of college because I wanted to do something. I had grown up in what I consider was the greatest country in the world. I wanted to give back in some ways, but I had also lost both my parents when I was a teenager, and pretty much along with my sister, we raised ourselves. And I thought I brought a unique perspective to the political work I was involved in, because I knew what it was to be downtrodden, and I knew what it was like to be on my own, and I knew what it was like to be broke. Thank God I was never poor, but as a child growing up, I was perpetually broke, and I started working full-time when I was 14. So I wanted to get involved because I saw that there was – you had the ability to change things through politics in America. So that's why I first got involved. And I just as I got involved with the Carter campaign, that's really how I worked for the president on his reelection campaign in 1980 – then I went to work for the Democratic National Committee. What I really ended up focusing on was campaigning, which I love doing. And I love the energy of it. And I love the fact that, you know, it's you have a very specific goal, and that's getting somebody elected. And it's got a very finite, you know, you have a very finite time frame. You've got till whenever the primary is until the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. So I like that aspect of it very much. And I ran a company for 25 years that helped politicians campaign. A lot of worked on a lot of presidential campaigns. Was Jesse Jackson's direct mail consultant, for example, and was worked for Gore and worked for Clinton. And that's really why I got involved. And then after 25 years, you know, I said, I should run for something. And I did, and I won. I couldn't believe it.
Wow. And you're an incumbent as well.
Yeah, I'm in my second 6-year term. And I ran against a very popular guy or well-known guy when I first ran, and I got somewhere between 80 and 90% of the vote. Citywide. Wow. And in the last election, I got 207,000 votes. So, yeah, I guess I know what I'm doing as a campaigner.
Well, it certainly sounds like the people are wanting to be represented. And I guess I must say I'm somewhat surprised, given that, you know, freedom is a big, you know, I guess, agenda in America, always has been. I'm actually surprised that I believe that the district of Columbia that you're
representing, our capital. It's interesting.
How is it that the people are not actually represented?
I didn't know this either, and I had never heard of shadow politics or shadow governor. And I didn't know that Jesse Jackson was also a shadow senator, I believe.
Yes, he was. And there have been a lot of them, actually. Goes back to 1789.
So
I'm sorry, 1794.
Perhaps you could explain to us how it is that, you know, a significant, I don't know whether you call it a state or a territory, but how is it that it's actually not represented that
with voting rights?
With voting rights. And, how can that happen in a democratic country?
Well, you know, it's an anachronism, really. What happened was the capital of the United States used to be in Philadelphia, and it was in several places, actually. It traveled around. Yeah, it was in New York and Annapolis and Philadelphia. And when it was in Philadelphia, a bunch of people, a bunch of veterans from the Revolutionary War came to Carpenter's Hall, where Congress met, and demanded to be paid. They hadn't been paid. And they surrounded Carpenter's Hall with torches and scared the congressmen, scared the first Congress. So they called on the governor to call out the militia. But, of course, the governor wouldn't do it because this is politics, right? And the governor of Pennsylvania is not going to call out a bunch of Pennsylvania soldiers to go attack a bunch of other Pennsylvania soldiers because he needs to get reelected. So what happened is Congress ran into New Jersey. They hid in New Jersey. And when they got to Washington, Madison, who was one of the framers of the Constitution, said, look, we need to be in control of whatever jurisdiction we inhabit. as the federal government, because we can't rely on any particular state to represent our interests. We have to represent our own interests. So as part of the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress shall have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the seat of government. So Congress can make any law or decide on anything in the District of Columbia. And in 1804, they decided that they would take our representation away. And they did. And we've been without representation ever since. In fact, it wasn't until 1961 that we could even vote for president. So we went for 60 years without even being able to vote for president of the United States. And it took a constitutional amendment to change that, the 23rd Amendment. And we do now have a mayor and city council. That's only been 40 years we've had that. But still, Congress controls everything in the the District of Columbia.
They are the lawmakers introducing legislation, and they're just as powerful as the executive branch, the president, and perhaps more so. So
Michael, why I'm just flabbergasted if the people did have representation. Why would the Congress, and how can the Congress?
It is confusing.
Take the vote away from the people when voting rights is one of the main. I'm assuming it's in the Constitution of America, the ability to vote. How could that happen?
I guess that D.C. is a bit of an anomaly. The capital, it's not actually a state. That's the basic reason.
That's exactly, yeah.
Citizens.
But this is not
They are citizens. And there are other examples of that in the United States. For example, Puerto Rico. All Puerto Ricans are citizens as well. But they don't have a vote in Congress either. And the difference between Puerto Ricans and residents of the District of Columbia, however, is that we pay federal income taxes. In fact, we pay the highest federal income taxes of any Americans. And we can't vote. And it is. It's an anachronism. And part of the reason for shadow politics, and part of the reason that I do what I do, is because it is un-American. And it is my belief that if America really knew this, that they would stand up behind us. We did a nationwide poll about 15 years ago that showed 80% of America believe we should have the same rights as everybody else, but an equal number of people, 80%, thought that we did have the same rights. Because why would you think, like you said, you never knew this existed. Well, why would you think? It's counterintuitive to think that the people at the seat of democracy don't have any democracy.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to. What is the is there an opposition to this? Or I mean, I don't.
Oh yeah, the opposition to this is it's completely partisan. The opposition to this is the fact that in the District of Columbia, we really have no Republicans. We have we have a 13-member city council, which is all Democrats basically. We have a Democratic mayor. We've never had a non-Democratic mayor. We've never voted for a Republican for president. Only Democrats have won the presidential vote in the District of Columbia. So Republicans don't want us to become a state, because if we become a state, we will have two Democratic United States senators, and that's what bothers them, 2% of the Senate. And that's a long-standing battle. The same thing happened to Alaska and Hawaii. There was a lot of opposition because people thought Alaska would always be Democrat and Hawaii would always be Republican. It actually is the opposite. But there was a lot of opposition. And that's really what this amounts to today. We have a statehood bill in both houses of Congress, and we have 142 co-sponsors. Each and every one of them is a Democrat, not one Republican co-sponsor.
I guess this has a lot to do with fear of change and power and control and the basic human issues, self-interest and that sort of thing, giving up things we think we're giving up and fearing that we're giving up things. And
perhaps the other big issue is freedom and I guess belief systems being, you know, people's belief systems, the country's belief systems being out of sync with, in fact, what actually is. And certainly in Australia, we have a perception of America as being one of the great countries where there's an incredible freedom, when people have an incredible freedom. However, I'm beginning to think that
civil liberties. Yeah.
In some ways, you know, Americans have less civil liberties than in Australia, and I'm just quite quite actually interested.
I've seen this as well, and you have a friend, a Sue, who's a medical specialist who's been around the world, and I think she's worked with the World Health Organization and whatnot. And she told me, in Australia, it's basically about, it's sort of majority rules, and it's about what's good for the majority of society rather than for the rights of the individual. Whereas in America, it's for the rights of the individual. But in doing that, there's so many laws and so many rights that there has to be enforcement of those rights. So there becomes more control and more laws, more complicated laws, and lawyers and police and law enforcement have to get involved in everything, compliance agencies, and it just actually becomes...
But you then have a contradiction, because if America is very much for the rights of individuals, obviously some individuals have a huge amount of rights, whereas others, like in D.C. Columbia, they don't have the right to vote. Such a contradiction, mm-hmm. I'm just gobsmacked.
Police and lawyers have much more authority than they do in Australia. In Australia, it's laws are much simpler, less complicated. Lawyers don't have the same type of presence here. There's not that many of them.
And the same with police. In fact, one of the things that astounded David when he came here, I remember David's comments were that the police are very nice here.
Diplomatic. And I would talk to the police officers and say that. I'd say, you know, you argue with a homeless person about moving on, where I know. And I was a constable in Massachusetts, which is an actual police officer, but it's an unusual thing because it's sort of like being a shadow senator. You know, I worked for the Massachusetts Tax Department Child Enforcement Unit, and I did evictions and some KPSs, civil arrest warrants, but I didn't actually work for the police department. I was also a special police officer, but constables are police officers, and they actually use that title. But I found that in America, you know, if you're stopped for a traffic ticket and you argue with that police officer, and I know this from being in the court system, you're going to be arrested on the spot. You're going to be thrown in jail for a week regardless until you get your arraignment. You're going to get charged with obstruction of justice, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest. You're going to get at least 5 charges. The prosecutors are there to get a charge on you because they assume that you've probably done something wrong at one time or another, even if you didn't do it this time. And I hate to be cynical about this, but having been in criminal defense for 20 years, this is what I've seen. And it's a system we have, and they're there to do a job, and so are the defense lawyers, and not a lot of people like defense attorneys either. But you're going to end up paying a lot of money for arguing with a police officer because you're going to pay probation fees for a year, because if it goes to trial, you're looking at a lot of jail time, and conviction is the word. And so it's generally people do settle and take probation, and they pay the court fees and the lawyer fees, and it's just a conveyor belt system. And that's why our jails are full, and it's a revolving door, and it's not that way, quite that way here.
In Australia, it's very different. It's sort of like, you know, you're innocent until proved guilty, and it actually takes a lot to take someone to court. And yet, laws like, you know, the police being able to stop a person driving and taking a breath test.
They did that to me, and I said that would never happen in America. I mean,
that's considered a riot.
No probable
and in fact, has really had a huge effect in reducing accidents. But I believe Americans such as David see that as a possible infringement of rights.
You need to have probable cause, and you need to have, you know, and here they pull you over, and that's just part of society, and it's accepted. And there may be some arguments with the police officers, and there'll be some negotiations, and people generally move on. And police officers were actually frustrated here about that in Sydney, but nonetheless, it's interesting.
So it raises a whole, you know, really fascinating themes of how to run a society and how to balance individual freedom with the rights of the community, and, you know, how the community has certain rights and may have to, I guess, try very hard to have those rights, such as voting rights, in the face of politicians who might obstruct that.
And some do, and there's some very good politicians, and there's and some that are more have their own interests, and I don't know, but I'm not going to.
Well, I think that is a conundrum in democracy in general, and I don't know how homogeneous the population is in Australia, but here, of course, in the United States, we have a very diverse population, and that exacerbates things to a certain extent, or has historically. Less and less, it's been America's great strength that we're this melting pot, but it's also been a, you know, something that we've had to deal with in terms of different customs and different laws. And you're right, it's a tough act to balance personal freedom against what's best for society. And we're seeing kind of some of the worst elements of that rear its ugly head right now in our presidential campaign with Donald Trump, for example. Some of the kind of terribly racist and divisive things this man is saying. And this was, you know, this is something you would have heard in America in the 1950s. We've really changed in the past 65 years. But it seems that this is coming to the forefront again, the things that are different about us. And the kind of politics, for example, that I hope I'm not getting too far off the track here, but the kind of politics that we're seeing right now with candidates like Trump are disturbing because they're, you know, they're the very oldest type of basic political or not basic, but base political manipulation.
Yeah, I don't like bad mouthing people, and I don't like dirty politics. And I saw a lot of this in the court system with destroying people's personal and professional credibility. And I'd see law enforcement investigators building a case with solid evidence over years and spending millions of dollars on a big case. And you know, you could have a defense lawyer come in and simply say this police officer's racist, and simply the evidence is now tainted, the forensic evidence and the chain of custody is in question, the witness's credibility is in question, and everything else, and everything gets destroyed and falls apart. And it's that simple because we're programmed to hear these remarks, and I don't like that kind of political campaigning where we target the candidate and try to destroy them, and that's sort of the American way.
It really is part of the, unfortunately, has always been part of the part of the process. You could look back as far as George Washington and see that there were dirty politics going on. You know that I once worked for a guy named Claude Pepper. Claude Pepper was from Florida. And we called him Senator Pepper because the rule in politics is you always refer to somebody by their highest office when they retire. So if you met Bill Clinton, you would still call him Mr. President. But Pepper But Pepper was a congressman. And we called him Senator instead of congressman because at one time he had been a United States Senator, but he had been beaten for re-election because this was back in the 40s, and many of his constituents were itinerant farm workers, and they ran ad campaigns against him, saying that he was a monogamist, that he practiced monogamy before marriage, and that he was a heterosexual. And many of his illiterate constituents didn't really know what monogamy before marriage was, but I'm sorry, he practiced monogamy, and before marriage he was celibate, and they didn't know what celibate meant, but it didn't sound good to them.
They tried to make that the negative term. I think I heard that story before too, where someone said, "And the candidate's daughter is a practicing thespian," and you know, and that sort of thing.
And you know, that's what they say is the ultimate political question: when a reporter says to you, "Have you stopped beating your wife yet?" You know, there's no way to answer that question. Can't answer it yes or no. There's no good way to answer that question. And very often they try to ask that question. And it really is. I mean, we had a president, Andrew Jackson, who felt that the press had killed his wife because his wife was married for one day to a cousin, and they never actually consummated the marriage. It was annulled the next day, but the press used to refer to her as an adulteress. And when they moved into the White House, she died within a few weeks of them moving into the White House. And Jackson said that, you know, he always felt that it was the American press that had actually killed her and the dirty politics. Yes, and he had a and this is an interesting story. He had a niece who was kind of a garish barmaid in Washington D.C., and he used to love to take her to all the official things at the White House just to annoy Washington society and the press, which he hated so much.
I must say, sounds like it's really hard to win. You know, either you get blacklisted for, you know, perhaps having numerous affairs, but I've actually never heard about being blacklisted for being celibate. But
put a negative connotation on that word to confuse people. But I had a web designer. I just want to say I knew a web designer, I should say, that had a billing dispute with a customer, and there was a little bit of bad mouthing going on, and the web designer decided, this is how I'm going to fix the problem. And he put up a website that said, a domain or a blog that said, this person is not a pedophile. And of course, that settled it right now, because people would say, why is that up there in the first place? Why is somebody saying this person is not a pedophile? That might mean maybe he actually is. And so the client simply said to the web designer, I'd like you to take that down because it's causing me some personal problems. Yeah. And that settled that, because I know, you know, from the court system that one of the ultimate, the worst labels you can get is to become a registered sex offender and have that label. And they do that with celebrities and actors and actresses all the time. He's a pedophile. Your reputation's destroyed. Now it's over. And that's a dirty tactic to use. But once it's out there, you know, and I shouldn't even actually say that, because I don't want people to do that, because it's morally wrong. And my simple philosophy of life is the golden rule, which means treat others as you wish to be treated. And you should always start from that fundamental attitude and go from there. And if you have to be a little bit assertive in life with people who are difficult, you negotiate that. But kindness is where we should start.
Look at John Kerry. You don't even have to go as far as Andrew Jackson. Look at John Kerry. Here's a man that had three Purple Hearts and a Silver Star. I've never even met a veteran that had three Purple Hearts. He had three Purple Hearts, a Silver Star, and he was a commander of a swift boat, which was considered one of the most deadly posts that you could be assigned to in Vietnam. And yet, veterans groups came out and called him a coward and tried to make him look like a coward. because when he came back from the war, he didn't believe in the war. And when he came back after doing his duty and serving his country, he burned an American flag. And they tried to make him look like a coward. Mm-hmm. And so it goes on. It still goes on in politics, and it's terrible. It's terrible to see Trump going to the lowest common denominator, though.
Now, I must say, as a therapist, you know, with adults as well as children and adolescents, and I see a whole lot of bullying, you know, in schools, in the workplace environment, and I guess what's coming to the fore for me at the moment is it sounds like politics is full of a whole lot of bullying, and what I find very frustrating about that is that we should be focusing on governing the world and doing the best for allowing humanity to have the most productive life and also making sure that we're taking care of our planet. And it sounds like there's an awful lot of, you know, primitive school tactics being used to blacken people's names, which is just not what politics should be about. In fact, I know of some people who have said that really politicians should be philosophers, people of very high moral caliber who can focus on the values that are really important in order to make this life a worthwhile life and represent the people that they're representing.
I think that's very insightful. I think bullying is a great way to put it. That's one of the reasons I'm involved. I had an experience very early on in life where I was bullied, and I stood up to the bully, and I've had a low tolerance level for bullies ever since. Mm, and I think that's great. One of the reasons I'm involved in this struggle in the District of Columbia, because it's just a matter of bullying. That's all it is. It's no other country in the world does this. No other country. We're the only one. So in fact, 11 countries have copied our constitution. I think Australia was among them. And they took out the provision that allows the government to control the capital city. So this is really just a matter of partisan bullying here in the District of Columbia. And yeah, that's one of the reasons I got involved. But yeah, there is a lot of that going on. We see it with the National Rifle Association in American politics all the time. There are industry lobbyists that bully politicians.
There are a lot of groups that do that, and then they push their agendas, and the gun attitude here in Australia is very different. Gun ownership is very different in Australia than in America, and it's different in Massachusetts and in Florida. I could say it's interesting. I think in DC, if I'm right, there are no gun licenses or guns allowed, and yet it's got the highest.
Tough gun laws. We've lost a couple battles in recent years with the Supreme Court, but yes, among the toughest, I would say the toughest gun laws in America.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, that would be a great topic to discuss. We might take a break just now, and then maybe when we come back from the break, I would love to talk about the whole issue of guns, because there's such a different attitude in Australia and America, and I find myself, it's a really difficult one. So why don't we take a break?
I can jump right in there and talk a lot about this issue.
Well, I would love to discuss that. So we'll take a quick break, and then we'll shoot back into the program.
And we'll hear more from Senator Michael D. Brown. Hello, welcome back to Universal Soul Love. This is Detective David Love.
And Dr. Lautner Love.
Today we're talking to our special guest, Senator Michael D. Brown of the District of Columbia, Shadow Senator and host of Shadow Politics on the BBS radio network right with us. And
and maybe you could, Michael, you have a website, don't you?
Yes, actually, we do have a website. We have a website. It's www.dcstatehoodnow.org. I'm sorry, I'm wrong about that. www.statehoodnow.org. Uh-huh. And that explains the whole thing about our fight for statehood. We also have because I am an elected official, we're part of the Washington, D.C. Website, too. You can go on to dc.gov and learn about our office and what we do. And we're actually creating a new one that will launch in about 30 days called Teach Democracy to use for high school, secondary school students to learn about our struggle for civil rights.
Civil rights, interesting. Mm-hmm. And recently we had Laura Eisenhower on our show, and before that we had Mike Tullinger with the Ubuntu Party, and very interesting. She's
yeah,
a great...
Laura has some interesting ideas.
She does. She says, I guess she's
a little different than her great grandfather.
Absolutely, vastly different from the family's views, I think, in general, and different, very different. And that's okay. She was a wonderful guest, and I enjoyed it very much. And
that's part of what makes politics in America a great thing, is that there is input, a lot of input from a lot of different sources. So it's one of our strengths. I mean, there's an upside and a downside to everything, but the upside is that we do have a lot of freedom, and we do have a lot of opportunity to engage in our society. Whether we do or not is another thing. You know, we were talking during the break about that very subject, about being engaged in our community or in community. And it seems to be less and less, unfortunately, in America. I was brought up in a bad neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey, which at the time in the 1960s, Newark was one of the worst places in America. We used to call it the government testing ground for social diseases. And we had a very small, tightly knit community. And my grandmother, for example, knew everything that was going on my street. She got involved. If she saw somebody she didn't know, she walked up to him and said, "Who are you?" I lived on Capitol Hill, and I was involved in two crimes in my neighborhood, which both resulted in arrests of perpetrators. And the police said to me, they said, "You know, great job. Thanks for getting involved." And I said, "This is what we do. You know, this is how I was raised. If you didn't, you call the police if you saw somebody robbing your neighbor's house, because the idea was if you didn't do that, next week they'd be back to rob your house." And we really kind of banded together, and I think in some ways had more a sense of community than we do today.
I guess that can bring us back to the topic of guns, because I get the sense, and obviously coming from Australia, we have a completely different set of laws and values about this. Mm. But I have the sense that, the part of the Constitution, the ability to own guns, is there as a sort of safety mechanism, and also possibly as a community responsibility, you know, the sense that it's police don't always get there in time.
I'm going to jump in on this very quickly and give you a quick synopsis. When I was in Massachusetts, there's a lot more, it's just different across the 50 states in terms of licensing and attitudes and ownership. And I've always had a gun, never had to use it or even think of it. Not an issue. I went to Florida, which is interesting. The crime is much higher in Florida than it is in Boston, I believe. And but interestingly, you know, and gun licenses are given out much more freely. But interestingly, you know, when I would there was even different parts of Florida, like the difference between say Ocala and Orlando, the people are different. In Ocala, I found that you knew who the people that were wearing the hunting shirts and the fishing shirts and the camouflage. They were always there with their concealed weapons, and you knew that, and you knew who they were. And yet, when you would walk in, when you were sitting in a restaurant, you knew who was around and who was armed. And I almost felt protected, because I knew that if somebody were to come into this restaurant and hold it up, there were people right there to defend you. So I don't know. Guns never solve problems, and I don't think that's ever a way to go. And I hope that no one ever has to even own a gun, or much less shoot a gun at anyone, because it's a very tragic thing. And any kind of shooting is tragic, and it ruins your life, and certainly other people and their families. And but a gun is. But it's interesting, because I think we were talking about just during the break that my view of this is that a gun is simply an object, and left on the table and left unto itself, it won't do anything. It will lay there until it's picked up by a human being, much like money. Money is simply an object, a currency, a tool, a concept, for good or for evil. And this is all about human nature and our attitudes and the way our country was founded during the revolution, different from Australia. And this is such a huge topic that could go in so many directions. But that's sort of my and I know even, you know, with Michael Tellinger, I once asked him that question in person. We went out to dinner. Because he's with Ubuntu, he's trying to introduce a moneyless system, because he believes that money is the root of all evil. And certainly guns and money can be manipulated for self-interests and for hidden agendas. And it's a vehicle for good or for bad. So he has a certain, Michael certainly has a truth. There's truth to that. So.
Well, you know, I think it's not that I disagree with your analogy that it's like, you know, if you leave a gun on the table, nothing happens. It is in itself inherently neither good nor evil. But our problem here in America, as far as I see it, is keeping the guns out of the hands of people that won't let them sit on the table, people that are crazy, people that are malevolent, the Second Amendment actually starts out a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the state. It was put in there because America didn't have a standing army at the time, so we depended on civilians to support the government. But unfortunately, a lot of these guys that stockpile multiple semi-automatic weapons are people that feel the need to protect themselves from the government. And, yeah. And you know, and when they get in the hands of paranoid schizophrenics, like they have in several incidences, you know, we had the horrible thing in Connecticut with the school children. And maybe you, doctor, since you're a doctor, maybe you understand this, because I don't. But I don't know how that guy sat in a church in Charleston and prayed with a bunch of people for over an hour, and then pulled out a gun and shot a dozen of them, killing most of them.
Terrible.
Yeah, and you know, we all know gun owners, responsible gun owners. I grew up around guns. I have police officers in my family, and you know, I had hunters in my family. I was trained to use a gun as a young boy, as a young man. I would never think of, you know, going in and killing a bunch of people at a shopping center because I was angry about something. You know, it's not a thought that would ever occur to me.
Most people, we've only got 1 minute left, unfortunately. I guess I should correct myself and say that guns are meant for killing. That's their purpose.
Yeah, they really are.
But Lana can jump. I just want to let Lana jump in for some closing thoughts.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just fascinating to compare the two cultures, because in Australia, it's very much seen as guns are not necessarily, and that guns can persuade people to commit acts of crime. So, and I think that the true answer is that it's neither. I mean, you have, it's not black or white. Mm. It's the influence of the context, you know. Mm.
The one thing that I can't get beyond is the fact that America has more guns than any country per capita, and we have more murders than
this
any
is true.
With guns.
We only have about
the more guns, the more murders.
Yes. We don't need guns. But anyhow, thank you so much for being on our show. It's a very exciting show.
Fascinating, you know, questions about, you know, how we rule countries, freedom, you know, the importance of the individual versus the majority. So, look, good luck in everything and getting representation for your people, because I think voting is very important. Part of the rights.
Yes, it is. Well, please spread the word. We've just joined an international organization, so we're taking our fight worldwide.
All right. Thank you for being on Universal Soul Love.
My pleasure.
This is Lana Love, Dr. Lana Love and Detective Dave Love signing off. We'll see you till next week.
Okay. Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye. Have a good week.